Welcome to the Donna Sebo Show. Donna is an international mental practitioner, award-winning author, counselor, speaker, teacher, and radio TV personality. Dedicated to empowering others through her mental skills, she also features authors and experts from all over the world to share their knowledge and experience with you, the listening audience. Now, let's join Donna and her guests. Here's Donna.
Hello and welcome. Welcome to an hour of mind power, and that's exactly what we're going to be discussing today. We're going to be discussing how an individual can perhaps make some assessments or be aware of some options, especially if they're having to deal with what they perceive as depression. But there are so many things that go on in today's world, and it seems as if we have almost like an epidemic with this kind of a subject matter. But we have a guest today, Eric Meisel, who has a very good way of, to quote his title, rethinking depression and how we need to really look at maybe changing some mental health labels that we have adopted perhaps a little bit too hastily. Eric, welcome to the show.
Hi, Donna. Great to be with you.
Now, you're a man who is a prodigious writer. You have written 40 books. You are very much involved as a creativity coach. You are a columnist. You're a featured blogger for Psychology Today in the Huffington Post. You are the founder of Noemetic Psychology, the new psychology of meaning. Now, tell us a little bit about noemetic psychology. What is it? How did you come to create that word? And for those of you listening, it's spelled N-O-I-M-E-T-I-C.
Yeah, it's a word that nobody knows quite yet. I chose it. I derived it from the Greek word for meaning noema. And for a long time, maybe 30 years, I wanted to update existentialism. I wanted to do that thing that the existentialist claimed was needed to be done, but they themselves didn't do. And that was to try to create a comprehensive life plan based on existential principles. And I've been writing about a fundamental paradigm shift from seeking meaning to making meaning for a long time in a number of different books, The Van Gogh Blues, Coaching the Artist Within, a number of different books I've been articulating this paradigm shift. And then I saw that just updating existentialism wasn't quite enough from my point of view, that a new psychology was needed that started from the fundamental place of trying to understand what matters to people, rather than starting from a pathology place where most psychologies start, where the beginning energy is to try to distinguish normal from abnormal. I thought it would be smarter to try to understand what meaning means to people and to base psychology on that information.
Depression. We have had so many words that have shifted over the years. Bipolar.
That's right.
Is a word that is a substitute for manic depression. And these words have shifted into different expressions, and lots of times people are very confused about this.
Naturally enough.
I just always have to chuckle, because for some reason there is a promotion of a utopia that we're never supposed to be sad, we're never supposed to be angry, we're never supposed to be depressed, and my goodness, I don't know of anybody that hasn't been.
It's a crazy idea.
I know. It's just amazing to me.
Yeah, it's as if we've signed up for one of those corporations, like maybe one of those supermarket chains, where your first job is to smile no matter what. It doesn't matter if you can make change, but you have to smile at all times. It's an odd idea.
You make a statement, it's right in your introduction, people need their freedom back, even their freedom to feel miserable. I really chuckled when I read that sentence, because I thought, how many times do we encounter someone that's down in the dumps? If you say, how are you? They say, I feel lousy. We just sort of go, oh, no, you're not supposed to say that. You're supposed to, just like you said, smile and say, oh, it's a totally magnificent day. And then go back to being, you know, in your own little world of misery. I don't know how people can grow in life if they don't have misery, if they're not depressed once in a while, if they don't see what is the downside. It just seems to be a part of life.
It does, and people have changed their inner language, just as you indicated. virtually no one says I'm unhappy anymore, or I'm sad, or I'm in anguish, or I'm in despair. They say I'm depressed. They've bought that word.
Mm-hmm.
And so a certain kind of transaction happens where they believe now that they're depressed as opposed to unhappy or sad or in anguish or one of those things. They walk into a mental health provider. They say I'm depressed, and they're handed back the mental disorder label of depression. A certain kind of transaction goes on there. There's no medical work done. There's no mental disorder of depression. There's a label affixed to a person who's unhappy. And that's what I'm trying to point out in the book, and that we have to be much smarter consumers and be careful about accepting these labels. We may want to accept the remedies that the mental health industry provides. The antidepressants are not medication for an illness, but they are chemicals with effects, and we may want those effects. So I'm not saying don't take antidepressants. We may want those effects. I'm not saying don't do psychotherapy, because psychotherapy is talk of a certain sort, and we may find that talk useful. It is only talk, but it's useful talk sometimes. So you do want to go to a mental health professional, because you may want one of those two things they're providing, namely chemicals with effects and talk of a certain sort, but you want to be careful about buying whole hog the idea that you have a mental disorder.
I agree with that. You have some statements in your book that I found extremely fascinating. You say the rise of four powerful constituencies, the pharmaceutical industry, the psychotherapy industry, the social work industry, and the pastoral industry, and their handmaidens, advertising, the media, and the political establishment, it's become increasingly difficult for people to consider that unhappiness might be a very normal reaction to some unpleasant thing. In other words, it is healthy to experience it.
Yeah, and I think... Go ahead, sorry, go ahead.
No, but I really wanted to point out a comment here that you had in 2002, and this was related by Charles Barber, 16% of the citizens of Winterset, Iowa, were taking antidepressants. And why is it that one in six of these typically stable people would be getting a prescription from a doctor, going to a pharmacy, and taking this stuff?
That's exactly right, and that was 2002. Now we're in 2012. Is that where we are?
I think that's where we are at the moment.
That's right, and it's probably doubled by now. Who knows? And if you begin, if culturally you begin to think that if your farm is failing and you're not happy in your relationship, et cetera, if normal things are going on, normal unpleasant things are going on, that the person you're supposed to go to is a mental health provider, then you're going to end up with this label of depression and you're going to end up with antidepressants. That's what you're going to go on. And you're going to get your life flattened out, and maybe you want that effect. Maybe you were in a tremendously deep hole, and maybe that effect is what serves you at this moment. But you're going to that mental health professional because that's what the culture says you're supposed to do with these normal human experiences now. I think one of the things we don't understand at all well enough is that lots of people, I would say tens of millions of people, have kind of evaluated life as a cheat. You know, it just didn't turn out the way they expected it to be or hoped it would be. They're being bombarded all day long with, you know, whatever, the newest Mercedes or the newest Cadillac or the sunniest vacation or whatever on TV. They're bombarded all day long. And so they have this picture of what life was supposed to be like, and they look at their life, and their life isn't like that. So they've made this evaluation, essentially this decision, that life is a cheat. And so they're blue all the time now. They're sad all the time now. It's kind of a low-grade sadness, but it's there. And so one of the most profound things a person could do is to think this through, the thing that I'm saying, just think it through and see if they have evaluated life as a cheat and if they want to change their mind about that and if they want to switch their opinion about life and look at it a little bit more optimistically.
I agree with you. I loved your skit that you had in the book about the depression counter. And it's quite long and quite evolved, but basically it would make a wonderful, wonderful program to have on, to have someone from Saturday Night Live
play out.
because I think it's absolutely terrific.
I have to tell you,
the money.
This is life imitating art. So I wrote that, and in that I describe how you can turn boredom into a mental disorder in 1 minute flat. And I think I succeed in turning boredom into a mental disorder in 1 minute flat. And you may know, I'm sure you do, that the manual that clinicians use to diagnose, the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual, the DSM, is going through a revision. And the new one is to come out in 2013, and we're going to have scores and scores and scores of new disorders. Just folks sitting around in a room making up disorders. We're going to have more of those. And one of them, it turns out, is a kind of apathy disorder. It's exactly like the skit.
I don't think they
couldn't have read my book. It wasn't out yet, but that is life imitating art, because you can turn any human phenomenon, boredom, apathy, this, that, or the other thing, into a mental disorder, lickety-split, by just doing a few operations.
And what is so fascinating about this is that many times people that are saying, well, this is your problem, and instead of saying, my goodness, why don't you just take a walk around the block, for heaven's sakes, and deal with some issues. We have evolved into believing what is being said to us on so many levels. And here, take a pill. This will fix you.
And yeah,
it doesn't work.
Well, we've been doing it for thousands of years. I mean, it's not so different from, you know, taking three shots of whiskey before a party because you're shy. You know, chemicals do have effects, and so the idea of taking a happy pill is just not very surprising. It's been going on forever. It's our job to decide if we really want to do that, and if the effects that the chemicals provide are worth it, given the side effects, and given that it may be a placebo effect. That maybe you caught the 60-minute episode maybe 2 weeks ago, where a Harvard researcher explained the results of his research, and for what's called mild and moderate depression, he could find no difference between the effects of antidepressants and the effects of placebos.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So we don't even know to what extent these pills have any real effects. They may just have those placebo effects. So people need to be smarter consumers. It's not that they shouldn't approach mental health providers. They should. And it's not that they should, so to speak, stay in the closet with their pain. They should absolutely air their pain and try to get help, but they still have to be smart consumers.
I think you have brought out so much good information about people in the industry. And it is an industry, psychotherapy, psychology. It's a very large industry. And I found it fascinating that a psychiatrist by the name of Daniel Carlatt, he said, doing psychotherapy doesn't pay well enough. I can see 3 or 4 patients per hour if I focus on medications, but only 1 patient in that time period if I do therapy.
That's
now,
right.
That's hideous.
Right.
That's hideous.
It's hideous, but it also speaks to, I think, a certain truth, namely, I don't think they believe that there is a mental illness there. If they thought that psychotherapy was effective, then I think there's a sense in which they would take the time. But if they think it's really human unhappiness, then what would you be chatting about if you'd be letting the cat out of the bag? So I think there's an extra reason why the mental health professionals of a certain sort, those who can prescribe, really want to just prescribe and not talk. And that's because I'm not sure they believe that there's a mental disorder. You know, there's no reason why you would or why any human being would read the definition of a mental disorder that the American Psychiatric Association provides. But if you tried to, I would not even try to inflict that on your listeners, but if you tried to read it, you would just see it as a string of words meant to contain anything and everything. It's mm-hmm. impossible to understand what this definition means. So I think that's one of the main reasons why we have to be very wary about the very idea of mental disorders. The first reason is that the definition of a mental disorder, I don't think, makes any sense. And the second is what we just chatted about, namely the idea of diagnosing on the basis of symptom pictures rather than explanations. No explanations are offered. There isn't even lip service paid to any explanations of what's going on. You're just diagnosed on the basis of symptom pictures. And there's no attempt to distinguish between predictable human reactions to life versus something pseudo-medical. So I'm repeating myself here. I think there's quite an enormous game going on.
I think in many instances there is. I do know that there are people that do have mental issues, very serious mental issues. But there are those that when you find, for example, someone says, oh, I've been going to a therapist for 13, 14 years, you go, excuse me? They must have been watching Monk. I mean, it just, I mean, that is a guy that's portrayed as someone who's brilliant but constantly going into a therapist because he's not able to deal with certain issues.
Right.
And it's very clear as to what that is. It's death, it's dying, it's losing someone that was very special to him. Yet he still does hold himself accountable as that character is portrayed. I liked your statement in the book that said, the world is not built to accommodate you. We're not entitled. Life is a pretty tough proposition. I don't care what side of the plate you've been born on. It is a real tough proposition. And accountability is very important. And I think that that is one of the things that is at issue today, because there are so many things that happen and people will say, oh, well, blame so-and-so, blame this, that, or the other. But people are not held accountable, and personal responsibility, where it was something at some time within the American culture, you're responsible for what you do. You're going to have to, if you destroy something, if you know, you're a kid and you get into trouble, okay, then you're going to have to do something to balance things out. You're going to be responsible for what you've done. And you really look at life, you're supposed to look at life straightforward in the eye. But again, I think it's very hard. I think depending on the generation you come up through, having that kind of honesty is not always going to be easy, because people around you in today's world say, oh, well, that's a fabrication. You just don't see things right. It's like the emperor in his new clothes.
Right. And people have little to say beyond, let's try to cheer up to other people. People aren't very good at speaking to other people about what's going on. It's really hard to just sit with somebody who's in pain without wanting to say something like, you know, can't you get over it? Or can we problem solve? You have a problem here. Can we solve it? You just lost your child. Can we solve this problem? No, that's not a problem that can be solved. That's grief.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and if you're going to be in grief for years or even forever in some sense, well, that's your human burden. That's what is.
You talk about meaning. You say there are three fundamental questions about living authentically. The first is, what matters to you? The second is, are your thoughts aligned with what matters to you? The third, are your behaviors aligned with what matters to you? Now, is there a reason why you chose those specific questions?
Well, I do think they're actually the most important, and I think if you can answer them for yourself, you will be happier. I'll give you a simple example. And I work with creative and performing artists a lot as a creativity coach, so a lot of my examples will come from that world. But let's say that you want to start a novel. That's your intention. You believe that will be a meaning-making enterprise for you. So you decide you're going to start a novel. Well, for most people, the next seven things they think are, well, I'm not sure I'm talented, and there's so much competition, and there are so many books out there, and I think it's really too late, and I've never really been very good at sitting still and blah, 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 blah. So the first thing they do is misalign their thoughts with that intention. And what happens is they get sad instantly. They formed a beautiful intention to write their novel. They thought several thoughts that didn't really serve them, and then they got sad. If they could have better aligned their thoughts with their intention, if they could have said, okay, now I'm going to start working on the book, and you know, I expect I'm going to have hard days, but I'm really looking forward to it, and blah, blah, blah. If they align their thoughts with their intention, then they would have enthusiasm, motivation, excitement to work, and so on. So I think this is an age-old idea. We make ourselves sad by the sorts of things we say to ourselves. And as the Buddha said, get a grip on your mind. You're the only one who can get that grip on your own mind, ultimately. And if you're not, it's not about the truth or falsity of your thoughts. You may be having true thoughts that aren't serving you. It may be true that there's a lot of competition out there for your novel. That's a true thought, but it's not serving you to think that. Doesn't help you work on your novel. So if we let go of the idea of, you know, true and false thoughts and think instead of what serves me to think, what aligns with my intention. I only want to think things that align with my intentions.
I really think that is so important. In fact, that was a theme of my editorial in my newsletter this month, that I had gone through watching some stuff on television, and boy, I was getting into a mental funk because there's just so much that wasn't right, and I was getting disappointed with this and disappointed with that, and finally I just had to turn it around and say, wait a minute, who am I giving this power to? I have the right to choose what is going to go into my mind, number one, and number two, I have the right and privilege to exercise what I'm going to do with what I choose to think. And I really feel that that is something that we have to learn, because most of us have been indoctrinated in one form or another. I don't care what part of the world you come from. I don't care whether you came from a good family, a bad family, mediocre family. It doesn't make any difference. We all have various things we're indoctrinated with. So to learn how to think and take control over our minds and our attitudes and to be real with them, that's our right and privilege. But there's a lot of stuff that says, no, it's not your right and privilege. You don't
have
the right to do this. And that is what your book is about. Your book is about waking up, becoming mindfully present and saying, wait a minute, I have this freedom. I am going to make these choices. And boy, that's a powerful positioning to put yourself into.
Yeah, and almost all the institutions of society are conservative with a small c. Families are, parents are conservative, schools are conservative, in the sense that they want children to do what they say. Parents, to be sure, parents may pay lip service to childhood independence and what have you, but when it comes down to certain things like, you know, the religion of the family or cultural beliefs or what have you, the parents want to pass that along and demand that those are passed along. Schools pass along conservative information too of that, of the same sort, whatever the culture is selling. And so it's very hard for a child to get freedom to think. To say it simply, I think all children pretty much are told to draw within the lines. Whatever those lines are, I mean, different lines in different cultures, but they're told to draw within the lines. And then some moment has to happen. Hopefully they're born stubborn and they don't agree with that injunction right from the beginning. That's a beautiful life if you disagree with that injunction right from the beginning. But let's say you don't. Well, then you have to find the courage later on to break out of those boxes and think for yourself.
And that, I think, again, is a process. It is a process of literally reverting back to that childlike part of ourselves that didn't know any boundaries, didn't really feel encumbered with a lot of labels. Now, there is an important thing on the side of culture, and that is usually there is some kind of order, some kind of law, and when that is not, and when that is not followed to a degree, then those boundaries can create some problems. So there's a lot of what is done meaningfully and with a right sense of, gee whiz, I want to do the best for my kid, by those that this is how they came up. But every generation is very different.
That's
and
right.
Discipline and all kinds of things need to be able to prepare a child for adulthood. And sadly, we're finding a lot of children are not even coming into adulthood until they're in their 30s or 40s, which is just mind-boggling to me.
And that's a meaning problem, too. I think a lot of people in their 20s and 30s are having trouble trying to discern what's meaningful to them.
Mm-hmm.
They understand maybe, you know, how to get a job or what work means, but they're not experiencing either life or their profession as meaningful. And so they're trying to wait out that meaning crisis, hoping that they can find meaning. At some point, it's going to strike them what's meaningful to them. That's, to me, the old metaphor of seeking meaning. An awful lot of people in those generations, teens, 20s, and 30s, are trying to wait out meaning and trying to seek meaning. And, you know, my argument is they have to make meaning. They have to make decisions earlier on rather than later as to what might prove to be a meaning opportunity for them and give it a shot. Better to give it a shot, better to try to decide that something might prove meaningful and then really do it, than to wait on the sidelines hoping that meaning will arrive somehow, sometime.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And there's a lot of adults that are still in that same status. You make a couple of statements. Focus on your intentions, not on your mood. Focus on meaning and not on mood, and you will reduce your experience of unhappiness.
Yeah, it's one of those odd things. Many of the things that we think are odd, and one of the odd things is that we should be checking in on our mood so much. We always check in on our mood when we're at our lowest. Nobody's checking in on their mood at a party or when they're cheering at a ball game or when they're having a hot dog with their kids. Then they're happy, and they're not checking in on their mood. And so they miss the opportunity to notice how often they're not in a bad mood. And so they check in on their mood when they're feeling low, because that's how we've trained ourselves to operate. Well, gee, I'm feeling low. Let me see if I'm feeling low. Oh, yes, wait, I am. So I think we can stop doing that better if we remind ourselves that our task, that our life is a project, and that we intend to make meaning, whatever that means to a given individual. And there are scores and scores of meaning opportunities. It could mean service, it could mean creating, it could mean relationships, it could mean stewardship, it could mean a million different things, but it has to mean something for a given individual. We seize our meaning opportunities and we let meaning trump mood. And by that I mean we work to accomplish our meaning efforts rather than checking in on our mood all the time.
You talk about negotiating each day, and I think one of the best things that has ever been said is you live the moment. You really live the moment. We all want to plan for the future, and you know, but don't get caught up with the past. Let the past take what the gold nuggets are from whatever you've been through, move them with where you are right now. But just really being present with the environment you're in, just really making that a sense of contentment and satisfaction, it's really quite a challenge, because so many times our brains are just buzzing. They're going thousands of miles an hour, and we're thinking about what we've got to do. My goodness, what if I don't do this and such a time for that? I really like the chapter that you had in your book on negotiating each day.
Yeah, and I suggest to clients and to the coaches I train the idea of a morning meaning check-in. Just take seconds. This is not like a half-hour sitting meditation or something. This just takes a few seconds to chat with yourself, not about the worries of the day or all the things looming up, but about where you would like to make meaning on this day, to announce your meaning investments to yourself about the day, and then to not trouble yourself about those parts of the day that aren't going to feel meaningful and can't be made to feel meaningful. For those portions of the day, you can stay in meaning neutral and not pester yourself about how the day is feeling. To say this more simply, you might decide to spend an early morning hour writing your novel and then not pester yourself about the 2 hours that you're running errands, not worry yourself about, is this meaningful or is this not meaningful? And then invest an hour in something else that you do believe is meaningful, and so on, and negotiate your day that way. And when you negotiate a day that mindfully, then you stop doing the things which amount to not negotiating the day, things like checking your email for the millionth time or searching the net pointlessly or doing all of what we might begin to call the, you know, distraction addictions, all the ways of distracting ourselves so that we can get these 5 minutes or 15 minutes or 30 minutes done with, and then we move on to our next chore or responsibility. We can deal with these distraction addictions much, much better if we are mindfully creating our day first thing each day in the morning and making decisions about where we want to invest meaning throughout the day.
I agree. And before we close, I want to share one of your other statements in your book. Life is a project. The moment they are born, people are dropped into a world that makes many demands and certain allowances. Either you equip yourself to deal with human unhappiness and the rigors of living, or you'll find yourself dealing with them in ways that make you even unhappier. I think that one of the joys of life is recognizing that each aspect of ourselves has a uniqueness to it. And it doesn't make any difference whether we're ever written up in People magazine or not, but living our life with a standard of excellence and intention and full purpose I think really is so significant. I know of people that most individuals will never know their names, but to me they're heroes and heroines because of the way that they have conducted their life with a realism and a sincerity and with sometimes so much love. It's just amazing.
That's
so
right.
I think that that's what we need to look for, are those people that we feel we'd like to emulate and emulate them in the right way so that we can be supportive of ourselves in the right way as well.
That's right. And my shorthand for from what you just said is we want to make ourselves proud. It's not about happiness. It's about making ourselves proud.
Mm-hmm. Your book, Rethinking Depression, has so many concepts of thought that I think are really, really good perspective. You say how to shed mental health labels and create personal meaning. What is your website, quickly, that people can go to?
The one for the book is rethinkingdepression.com. I invite folks to go there. My home website is ericmaisel.com, ericmaisel.com.
Thank you, Eric. Rethinkingdepression.com or Eric Maisel, ericmaisel.com. Check it out. Remember, you're the one that controls your mind, and it is phenomenally significant. Don't let other people do it for you. This is Donna Sebo. We're taking a break. Thank you, Eric, for being my guest. We're going to be back in just a moment.
It's time to get your glow on. March 2nd through 4th at the Northwest Women's Show, a show that's all about you. 400 exhibits, 5 entertainment stages, over 60 seminars, and best of all, shopping. New this year are special theme days with prizes. On Fitness Friday, wear your tennis shoes. Then stay for Girls Night Out from 5 till 8, packed with wild and crazy fun. The Fashion Police will be there on Stylin' Saturday. And let your glow shine on Spirit Sunday. Meet actress and author Linda Evans, Dave from Dave's Killer Bread and his rockin' band, and Hollywood numerologist Glynis McCants, plus fashion shows from JCPenney, favorite authors Anne and Leslie Rule, and back for all 3 days, Seattle's hottest firefighters. Northwest Women's Show, sponsored by Safeway, BECU, Constant Contact, and Como TV, at CenturyLink Event Center, March 2nd through 4th. The Northwest Women's Show, it's such a girl thing. Learn more at nwwomenshow.com. It's time to get your glow on. March 2nd through 4th at the Northwest Women's Show, a show that's all about you. 400 exhibits, 5 entertainment stages, over 60 seminars, and best of all, shopping. New this year are special theme days with prizes. On Fitness Friday, wear your tennis shoes. Then stay for Girls Night Out from 5 till 8, packed with wild and crazy fun. The Fashion Police will be there on Stylin' Saturday. And let your glow shine on Spirit Sunday. Meet actress and author Linda Evans, Dave from Dave's Killer Bread and his rockin' band, and Hollywood numerologist Glynis McCants, plus fashion shows from JCPenney, favorite authors Anne and Leslie Rule, and back for all 3 days, Seattle's hottest firefighters. Northwest Women's Show, sponsored by Safeway, BECU, Constant Contact, and Como TV, at CenturyLink Event Center, March 2nd through 4th. The Northwest Women's Show, it's such a girl thing. Learn more at nwwomenshow.com.
Hi, this is Donna. Welcome back. Telephone number to call in to if you'd like for me to light your life up with a little bit of insight. And the telephone number to call in to is 888-627-6008. That's 888-627-6008. If you're a first-time listener, I'm so delighted you've decided to join us. And if all you have to do is call in and give me your first name, or your initial, whatever you prefer, and then just let me tell you what I perceive. By the way, the newsletter went out, and in the newsletter, I've got an absolutely awesome recipe, plus all kinds of good information. And my editorial in my newsletter has a video link about the tsunami in Japan and what has happened in the year. It is a powerful movie, and I invite you, if you do not get my newsletter, go to my website. My newsletter is going to be posted there. And then look it up, because I think you will be amazed at what these phenomenal people who had help from around the world have been able to do in 1 year. It is just phenomenal. Anyway, that's gone out, and I also have all of the postings regarding the guests that are coming up. Now, tomorrow, we are going to be replaying a program that was done a couple of weeks ago, and this is on liftoff leadership. It is absolutely a wonderful, wonderful interview, and I hope that you will join us. I am going to be at the Women's Show, and I was over there setting everything up early this morning and got in just a short time ago. Oh, my goodness, what a wonderful event this is going to be, the Northwest Women's Show, and I'm so pleased to be a part of it. And go on my website. You will find information about the event, or go to northwestwomensshow.com, and you will find all of the information you need regarding the details for the tickets, parking, etc. But wow, it is just going to be another dynamic event. I have been going for so many years, and I'm going to be in booth number 402, but I have the forum tomorrow, and we're in our sixth year doing that, where I bring in experts and people that are wonderful authors from the Pacific Northwest. And then also, there is going to be a talk I'm going to be giving on Sunday, but I'm available for many sessions while I'm there. And it's just a terrific event. And gals, it is a great way to buddy up and to get with people you enjoy spending time with. Oh, there's so much there to see, do, good food, good times. You're just going to have a blast. So I look forward to seeing you there. Stop by and say hello, won't you? We're also going to have a drawing. We are going to be having a drawing for an special enchanted tarot deck. Oh, it's just beautiful. So we're going to have that, and there's so many other good things that are going to be shared with you, so come on by, plus a lot of books. So just plan on coming by. It's going to be a dynamic 3 days. I wanted to share with you something about nostalgia. And when I came across this information, I thought, this is so really, really cool. And there was a couple, Drazen and Olinka. They had broken up, and this was, you know, a couple of years ago. And they joked about creating a museum in Croatia, which is where they're from, to display the remnants of their time together. And they had like a little white wind-up rabbit, and then They were just talking about this. This was just fun stuff for them. Well, the former couple, 3 years later, put the toy bunny in a local art festival alongside dozens of other items that friends had had that had special nostalgia. Do you know, they ended up attracting hundreds of people, and they opened up a museum of broken relationships. Can you imagine? That's what they did. Do you know, it has become a traveling exhibition. It has gone to more than 15 countries, including 4 U.S. cities, and they have collected over 800 donated items, most of them anonymous. And if you have something that maybe you have from a broken relationship, you can donate it if you wanted to get rid of it, but you were one of these very, very sensible people that said, I just can't throw this away. I've got to figure out where I'm going to put it. Well, get in touch with them. You can go to brokenships.com, brokenships.com, and there's a plaque that goes along with each piece that lists the duration and location of the relationship behind it, and sometimes even more. Now, would you want to go to a museum like that or even see an exhibition like that? I mean, to me, if something's not worked, who cares? Move on. But for a lot of people, it's fascinating to see what other people have gone through. And so what these two people that no longer are in a relationship, a personal relationship, but are in a business relationship now said, they try to create an emotional roller coaster for the audience. Well, you never know. There's just all kinds of things that go on. And just a little bit of trivia that is just really, really nonsensical. 43% of people who are married didn't know their partner's credit score before they tied the knot. Well, I think that's more true than not. Yes. Anyway, that's a little bit of trivia for you. I thought that was just some fun stuff here. This is Donna Siebel, 888-627-6008. 1-800-848-0808 is the telephone number to call into. Well, though we are doing a Best of Donna tomorrow, next week, we are going to be having a wonderful grouping of people. We're going to be, well, leaning into sharp points with Stan Goldberg. We're going to find out How You Can Die in Paris by Noturi Thomas. And Writers on the Edge, Diana Robb, is an author along with a partner that's collected some amazing stories. And Dance of the Electric Hummingbird. How do you think a rock star could affect your life? Well, we'll find out from Patricia Walker exactly how one affected her. So we've got a fascinating lineup of people. Kids. Kids have to play. I think that there is such a need for children to get dirty, to get out, to explore bugs, to dig up rocks, to play in the dirt. Well, I know in certain parts of Washington, you don't want your person or your child to play in the dirt because there's arsenic in the dirt. And there's so many things today parents get so concerned about. And I heard an interesting study about kids, and that is that these games, the Y games that they get up and they dance to and all this kind of stuff, they thought, boy, this is going to make kids exercise more. Nope, doesn't do that at all. In fact, they find that the kids actually sit just as much as they did before the games were even introduced. That really isn't inducing additional exercise. Childhood is a time when you need to be able to exercise your imagination. You need to be able to climb trees, to explore things. And sometimes you might fall down and go boom. Well, that's just the way it is. I was watching a group of kids in our neighborhood that were in a cul-de-sac, and they were riding their bike, they were playing basketball, they're out, they're just all this noise. They're just making all kinds of noise. And I think it's very healthy. That's the way it should be for kids. They need to develop social interactions and be able to be out there and to experiment and explore life. They need to be taught things for safety purposes, but they have to have a chance to be able to develop. And I think that this is very, very important. And too many times, the television or video games are replacing this kind of activity. And it is important activity because it helps to develop the brain. It helps to develop problem solving. And it's something that helps curb their energy. I mean, that's why so many times I can remember when my daughter was small, they'd say, get her a dog. The dog can wear her out. And I think upon that today, and that's why labs and other dogs have been so wonderful with kids, because the kids can ride them and they can be out there playing and the dogs run with them and they run and run and run until they get so exhausted they just burn themselves out. Well, that's normal. That's not abnormal. That is a healthy thing. Learning how to be responsible is something that's very important. Well, playgrounds are apparently not so popular as they used to be. About 25% of children ages 9 through 13 really don't even have free time for physical activity. And, as I mentioned, a child is 6 times more likely to play a video game as to ride a bike. So, there are people that are saying, what can they do to make playgrounds more interesting? Well, I think anytime you can climb, you can swing, you can move, you've got a puzzle, a labyrinth you can go through, things like that are really great. Well, they are coming up with what they call the super playground. And this is one that's called the Geometry Playground. And this is in San Francisco. It's in their exploratorium. Now, what this is geometry. That's right. They're using geometry as part of the play space. Children roam through walls of torqued cubes, parabolic curves, and wavy mirrors. They're allowed to play with stacked forms. I'm seeing a bunch of hexagrams in front of me that I'm looking at. They climb gyroids and, you know, all kinds of stuff. But what it's doing, it's encouraging them to learn math. They're becoming acquainted with the forms of geometry without even being aware of what they're doing. They're just really very much involved. And then in Amsterdam, Walhalla, And they say when a jungle gym is compressed, it turns into a maze, a fortress, a rock climbing wall, or a soccer goal. And there are those that have been built, and they say 60 children can fit in them. And it's about 16 feet tall and 52 feet long. And the kids just love it. Kids have wonderful, wonderful minds. And then also landscape structures. There's a Mobius strip that is a climbing wall made of textured anodized aluminum, and it's got polyester, resin, fake rock handholds. The kids can climb and explore. And they say it's helping kids that have sensory processing disorders. See, they need to move. They need to stretch. They need to develop all of those things that go right into the brain that enable them as adults to have a healthy, very physically balanced body. Donna Sebo here. We're going to take a break. When we come back, I've got some spooky stuff to share with you and a little bit of this and a little bit of that. Don't go away. 888-627-6008. We'll be right back.
Are you concerned about nutrition? Do you work hard to eat right, try to feed yourself and your family nutritious food? Well, you'll want to know about glyconutrients. What are they? These are sugars that are present in nature. However, we're not getting them in our food anymore. Scientific study is proving that these sugars are necessary for all cellular and immune system function. Over 20,000 studies are conducted each year on glycoforms alone. These are the sugar protein structure that line each and every cell of the body. 4 out of the last 8 Nobel Prizes in physiology have been awarded for research in the area of cellular communication and how these sugars work in the body. This is Donna Sebo. Every day I bring to you information that will empower and light up your life. I would like to invite you to visit my website, DelphiInternational.com, and find out more about these glyconutrients. That's DelphiInternational.com. Go to my website, go to the left side of the screen, tap on the button that says glyconutrients. MIT's Technology Review, February 2003, states that glycomics is one of the 10 emerging technologies that will change the world. Education is the key to advancement of understanding and making our lives better. Visit my site, DelphiInternational.com. Go to the left side of the screen and tap on the button that says glyconutrients. I know it'll make a difference for you, as it has for me.
Are you taking too many oral pain pills and concerned about the side effects? Are you having trouble getting to sleep at night because of the pain? Well, I'm Lou Paradise. I had the same problems you have, cured my pain, eliminated pain pills and their side effects by developing Toprasin, pain relief and healing cream. Toprasin relieves pain without the side effects. It doesn't burn, it doesn't smell, and it doesn't stain. But don't take my word for it. Doctors, pharmacists, and pain specialists are using and recommending Toprasin and ending the suffering for thousands of people just like you. We know you hurt. We want to help. We are so sure that Toprasin will work for you. We offer a money-back guarantee. So if you want the pain relief without the side effects, ask for Toprasin. Toprasin is available at Duane Reade, Quick Check Pharmacies, and Wegmans. Ask for Toprasin or call 1-800-959-1007 for a store near you. That's 1-800-959-1007. Toprasin, the last pain medicine you'll ever need, and you can sleep on that.
Hi, this is Donna. Give me a buzz if you want to chat. 888-627-6008. If you think the paranormal is limited in where it can happen, no way. It's around the world and even in outer space, which Edgar Mitchell will testify to. But this takes place in Nova Scotia. And this is a story that occurs in Glacier Bay, and this was in 1963 on April the 16th, and it was in the family home of a man by the name of Douglas MacDonald. Now, the house caught fire, and they thought, because of the age of the house, it was quite an old home, that it probably was due to faulty electrical wiring. Well, naturally, the whole family leaves the house, and they're out of it until it gets fixed. Now, Mrs. MacDonald went back to the home. The mess, of course, had been cleaned up, and she was putting new furniture in when the insurance agent stopped by. Now, while the insurance agent is visiting with her, he smells smoke. And he's trying to figure out where the odor is coming from. I mean, this place had just been cleaned up. She'd just gotten in there, arranging some new furniture. By golly, he says, second floor, goes outside, flames. Well, the agent naturally was right there, but because of this happening, even though the agent saw this, the McDonald's, their insurance wouldn't cover the second one. Why? Because nobody could explain why there was a fire in the house. The current was non-existent. The electrical connections had not been turned on. So the McDonald's opted to completely rewire the house as it was being rebuilt for the second time. A month later, the house, still under reconstruction, a fire alarm. It's on fire. The firemen came and had to extinguish a bathroom blaze. They had no more gotten that out when there was a blaze in the closet. Investigators went out to this house. There were no combustible materials, no traces of heat or fire between the two different episodes, which took place 10 feet apart and on opposite sides of a wall. Story doesn't end there. A third blaze burst forth inside of a cupboard 2 hours later, followed by flames on their back porch. Now, this is really very unusual, wouldn't you say? The police chief of the town was called. He was standing in the house when he saw the baseboards catch fire. After that, there was never another fire in the house. And believe it or not, the McDonald's moved back into the house. Would you move back into the house? I don't think I would have. I think I would have said, whatever, whoever was there was entitled to it. If they didn't want me there, thank you very much, I would have gone someplace else. Oh, well. But these are stories. These are documented. This is not woo-woo stuff. This is for real. They haven't a clue why it was all over the house. So whatever was causing it was very, very unique. Donna Sebo here, 888-627-6008. A reminder, tomorrow I will not be live on the air with you. I will be at the Pacific Northwest Women's Show, which is an exciting event in Seattle. I'll be there for the next 3 days, and I will be hosting a forum of five people tomorrow. And then on Sunday, I will be talking and discussing Spirit Talk at 11:30 in the morning at the event. So we'll be coming back live on Monday, but we've got a great show for you tomorrow, so don't miss it. Are you aware that in your wrist area, that you have acupuncture points that connect to organs throughout your body? Well, if you're nauseous, well, all you have to do is, with your palm up, move 3 finger lengths down from the top crease in your wrist and press in the center of your forearm. Now, what this does, it releases certain neurotransmitters such as serotonin, dopamine, or endorphins, which then block other chemicals that cause nausea and vomiting. Now, there is a physician who is the director of the Center for Integrative Medicine at the University of Maryland that gives out this information. And they've done studies on it, and it works just fine. So there's also anti-nausea bands like C-bands sold at drugstores specifically target this acupuncture point to bring you all-day relief. Well, that's going to do it for the Donna Sebo Show. We're just about out of time here. I'm so delighted you were able to join me. Be sure to tell your friends about the show, and we'll be chatting again soon. Remember always, you're the master of your fate. You are the captain of your soul. This is Donna Sebo. Talk to you later. Bye for now.
You have been listening to The Donna Sebo Show. If you would like a copy of today's broadcast, send $10 to The Donna Sebo Show, P.O. Box 97272, Tacoma, Washington, 98497-0272. Be sure to put the date of the broadcast in your request. If you are not able to be a part of today's program, join Donna and her guests Monday through Friday, and she will be here to take your calls. Thank you for listening and being part of our program. Have a wonderful day.